Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscawain. Billions of pounds of perfectly good food are thrown out every year in the U.S. Our guests say about 40% of food produced here doesn't get eaten and doesn't go to the hungry, but instead ends up in landfills where it helps contribute to global warming. Food is squandered at the farm, at restaurants, grocery stores, and of course the home kitchen. And the issue has generated so much concern that Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack announced a goal to reduce food waste in the U.S. by half by 2030. It's a daunting task, and it's also one of global concern. In this hour, we delve more deeply into how we got to a place where so much is wasted and how we get to that 2030 goal, if possible. We're joined for the first part of the hour by Dina Gunders, staff scientist at the National Resources Defense Council and author of the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. Hi, Dana.
Good morning.
Good morning. And joining us also from the Harvard University studio is Emily Broad-Leib, assistant clinical professor of law and director of the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic at Harvard Law School. Welcome, Emily.
Good morning, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And also later this hour, we'll get some recipes for using up the food we often toss out. But first, let's look at exactly where food is going to waste. And since it's farm stand season, we'll start with agriculture. Dana, we're talking about a third of all food waste here.
Well, it really depends on the product, but there's, you know, we don't have great information at the farm level, but there we know that a lot of food is going to waste, and it's happening oftentimes just because it doesn't look quite right. Maybe it got a scar as it was growing up as a fruit or a vegetable. Maybe it didn't grow up to be the right shape or size. And so there's, for some crops, some years, you do have 20-30% of the crop that's never making it off the field, simply because of its cosmetics.
Really?
There are other reasons as well, things like low prices. When prices vary so much for fruit and vegetables, farmers get stuck sometimes where it would cost them more to harvest the product than they could actually get back in the price it would be sold for.
Are low prices something that can be helped? I mean, I guess it's tough to look into the crystal ball to see what's happening there.
Well, you know, it does seem that when long-term contracts are in place, that can help. You know, some people may sign up for shares with a farm called CSAs, or those types of things do help because they give the farmer kind of an assured buyer for their product, and that can help.
Let's get back to the consumer, and Emily, bring you into the conversation here. Is the consumer at least partly at fault here because, in general, we're a bit too particular?
I think that that's definitely true. There's a lot to say about what's going on the consumer side, where we actually see the most waste across the food supply. I think as related to farms, one of the other challenges is that farms are sort of off. They're in rural areas. If there is food that is not going to market for whatever reason, they're also places where it's most costly to get that food from the farm to, for example, a food bank or people in need. So I think that's why we see that there's a lot wasted on the farm. And in a lot of cases, it's the most healthy, fresh food. And, you know, I think it's a place for a lot of opportunity to figure out how to get that to consumers, how to get consumers to accept those imperfect fruits and vegetables. But then also, if it's not going to make it to market, how can we support those costs that a farm would bear to get them off of the farm and to people who might need them?
And to that point, Dana, I mean, that was the next part of the equation. If it's going to waste, why can we not get it to food pantries? I mean, that just seems kind of an unconscionable situation.
It's true, particularly when you think about fresh fruits and vegetables on farms that are, you know, perfectly healthy and nutritious. You know, well, as Emily said, that logistically it can be challenging. You know, for instance, about 80% of all the country's lettuce gets grown out in California, and it's expensive to transport that. So it may be that the food bank very close to where it's growing, it has full, you know, has more lettuce than they know what to do with. But out in Ohio, they would still love to get more lettuce. That's one challenge. Another is that there's, you know, our whole emergency food system was put into place really geared towards non-perishable foods. And only now is it growing in its capacity to take things that need refrigeration. So you might be able to get it to that food bank in Ohio, for instance, but that food bank may not have a big refrigerated room to put a whole semi-truck load of lettuce into and then get it out to all the agencies that need it. So a lot of it does come down to logistics.
And also, too, speaking of something that I read in the New York Times, retailers, wholesalers, and food service companies might reject an entire semi-trailer of produce just because they see a single crushed box or carton. They can't just ditch that one crushed box, Emily?
That's a great question. I mean, they could. I think there's a lot of the burden gets shifted back onto the farms and onto the people earlier, more upstream in the distribution process. So, I mean, of course they could see one crushed carton, and I would hope that they would make better decisions and say, well, that's one, let's take the rest of this and let's work this out. But I think often, and this is going to be a recurring theme in this discussion, when we're not thinking about food waste and we're only thinking about food safety, you know, not that we shouldn't have food that's safe, but food safety, the cost, you know, when we're prioritizing other things, it's really easy to end up wasting food. And I think what we're really seeing nationally right now, hopefully, is a shift in mindset around that. So maybe saying if there's one, you know, one carton that's off, we'll take the rest of it and we'll figure out how to, you know, get paid back for the one that was off. And so I think this will come up a lot that it's really easy to ignore food waste because it goes away and no one has to think about where it goes. But if we really start internalizing those costs and thinking about the burden, then we might make some different decisions.
And indeed, there are some really interesting startups out there which apparently are trying to recover food, like something called Food Cowboy, which uses a mobile app to connect rejected truckloads of fresh food to charities and other organizations. Dana, do you see this as a movement that is in its infancy, or is it becoming well established?
I think it's very much in its infancy, but growing quickly as infants do, right? And, you know, I wrote a report on this in 2012, and at the time, was when I was researching it, felt like nobody is talking about this, and these numbers are just shocking. You know, 40% of food is going to waste, and 25% of the water in this country is going to grow food that never gets eaten. Just really amazing numbers that I felt, wow, I can't believe nobody's talking about this. And in just 3 short years, as you mentioned, after that, you know, we had Secretary Vilsack and Secretary McCarthy holding hands to make an announcement to reduce food waste, you know, by 50% by 2030, which was an extremely ambitious goal.
Yeah.
And so in those 3 years and since, it's, I think, gotten a huge amount of momentum and attention. And what we're seeing now is that attention is, you know, I think there's a curve, it's following, and it's starting to really turn into action. And we are seeing a lot of startups, as you mentioned, taking on different pieces of the issue. And it's important to remember that this isn't just one issue. This is really about making the entire food system more efficient. And that means different things at different parts of the food system. And so it's going to take a lot of different narrow solutions that add up.
Yeah,
to solving it.
We're going to be talking about a number of those different parts to this question, but I'd like to get to climate change. Food waste is also associated with climate change. 7% of all global emissions, according to the UN, Emily?
That's right. I mean, I think this is, if you ask me about why, in addition to the great work Dana's done and some of the work we've done together raising and others raising the profile of this, I think that's why we're seeing a lot of attention, because at the same time, countries are trying to figure out what they're going to do about climate change and realizing that in a lot of ways, addressing food waste is a win-win. It's a way to make a really big dent in our emissions, both because of emissions related to agriculture that are doubled when we end up throwing away almost half of the food that we produce. And then emissions related to food waste in landfills, which is a contributor to methane, which is a really potent greenhouse gas. And so I think countries like the U.S. and others that are looking at how can we impact climate change have seen this as a really great potential where there's opportunities, as you said, Mary, for new innovations, new business, new growth of jobs, getting food to people in need, and really being more efficient about the food we're already producing. So it's unlike other areas where, you know, addressing climate change might be at odds with business. This seems to be one where a lot of people can benefit, and there's an economic opportunity as well.
Mm. Back to agriculture for a moment. There's also factory farming, which has its own set of issues. And Emily, you say a lot of resources and energy go into producing animal products.
That's right. It's actually been interesting, Dana sort of alluded earlier to, you know, depending on what product, you might see different amounts of waste. And I think it's actually important to look at certain products that have a bigger environmental impact and when we're wasting those. So, for example, we've done a lot of work on issues around milk being wasted. I know we'll probably talk a lot later about date labels, but when milk is past the date and people throw it away, I mean, you don't think about, I think something like 50 gallons of water go to produce 1 gallon of milk. So, you know, and fields being harvested with corn and soy, et cetera, that is for animal feed, when we then throw away a lot of those products, it has a huge impact on our natural resources and on the environment.
Dana, which animal industries leave the lightest footprint?
Poultry tends to have a lighter footprint, and fish can as well, sort of depending on which fish, and, you know, if you're following the Monterey Bay Aquarium has a great list of kind of which are well fished and those kind of things. You know, red meat, cattle, beef has the greatest impact, and pork kind of falls somewhere in between.
All right. Guessing that food waste is primarily a first world issue, Emily?
That's a great question. It's actually a global issue, and I think there's a distinction to be made between what's known as food waste, which we're primarily talking about in the U.S., and what's called food loss, which is a bigger issue kind of in developing countries. Food loss is the term given to food that's lost along the way. So, you know, it's harvested off the field. It looks great, and there's just limited cooling. The cold chain isn't kept. It's not able to be gotten to market in time and kind of gets lost along the way. And that's a huge issue. And in the U.S. primarily, but also in Europe, we face a bigger challenge with food waste, which means food that got all the way up the chain, got all the way really to the restaurant or the grocery store or into a consumer's home, and that was where it got thrown out. And in a lot of ways, I think food waste, they're both really big issues, but in food waste, when you think about the food having gone through so many steps along the chain before it's thrown away, has a bigger environmental impact.
All right, we're up against a break. Emily Broad-Lieb is Assistant Clinical Professor of Law and Director of the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic. Dana Gunders is Staff Scientist at the National Resources Defense Council and author of the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. And as always, we'd love to hear your input. The lines are open at 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Billions of pounds of good, usable food are lost to landfills every year as millions go hungry across the globe. And here to talk about this, Emily Broad-Lieb, Assistant Clinical Professor of Law and Director of the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic at Harvard Law School. And Dana Gunders is Staff Scientist at the National Resources Defense Council and author of the Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. And we've got comments and calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and we'll get to some of those comments in just a moment. But Emily Broad-Lieb did want to tackle another huge source of waste. You'd alluded to it just a couple moments ago. Sell by, use by, food safety dates, and Emily, you write about the tug of war that goes on in many families, including the one in which you grew up.
That's right. Well, I'll say, first of all, this is something, you know, I we've worked on, Dana and I together, over the past about more than 3 years. And as you mentioned, Mary, in my house growing up, there was this confusion that I think it permeates so many households around the country, which is my dad would keep milk in the refrigerator well past the date as long as it smelled and tasted good. And my mom was disgusted by it, you know, once the date passed, even if the milk was totally fine. So she would kind of go out and buy her own carton of milk and there would be two side by side. And, you know, and I think it was this question of this fear of safety that so many people have. Yeah. The real problem is that there's no federal regulation of these dates. So they're not standard. There's a million different dates on products, and we've done a really bad job of helping consumers to understand that food is almost always safe after that date. It's really about freshness and quality and taste, which is quite subjective.
So Dana, there is a lot of confusion. There's no rhyme or reason to this.
That's right. You could go into a store and look at the same brand of milk or orange juice, and even different sizes of containers, you know, the half gallon versus the gallon, might have different types of dates on them. That's kind of how pervasive the confusion and the mixed messaging around these dates are. So, you know, bottom line, what people should know is that their estimates, they are really about quality and not safety. The only products that you should really take those dates with a little more seriousness are those they tell pregnant women to avoid. That's the rule of thumb. Things like deli meats and unpasteurized dairy products.
So food safety outbreaks like salmonella in chicken, that's not necessarily linked to a jumbled labeling system, Dana?
That's right, yeah. You know, when people get sick from food, it's because it's contaminated, not because it's old. And when food ages, it goes through a natural process of decay. Those bacteria and enzymes, they do not make people sick. What makes people sick are contaminated, pathogens that contaminate food, like salmonella and E. coli. And that would be on your food whether, you know, you just bought it or if it had been sitting around a while.
So if I've got my refrigerator door open and I'm looking at a package of turkey breast, you know, that's been sitting there, it's like a week past the sell-by date, what's the red flag, Emily, if there is one?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not sure if you mean sort of deli meat.
Well, for anything, really. What are the red flags that you should look for if it's past the sell-by or best before date?
For most products, I mean, it's really a question of whether you're going to cook it or not. And I think for products that you're going to cook, you know, if they were contaminated for some reason, you would generally cook and kill whatever contamination was in there. And for other products, I think it's sort of back to our roots of really knowing, paying attention to food. Does it smell okay? Does it look okay? You know, and I think this gets back to kind of a lot of things that we can do in our homes to reduce food waste, which is knowing our food, knowing what to do with it. If it's, you know, if there's a little bit of mold on cheese, that you can cut that piece off. But if mold is sort of pervasive, you might want to throw that out or put it in the compost bin. Yeah. I want to underscore a point made earlier, which there's Walmart, which is the largest retailer, just aligned all of their private label food products to have a best if used by date to indicate quality. And they did this after doing a study of all the foods in Walmart and realizing that there were 47 different date labels used. And I can't even come up with 47 possibilities. So I think to this point that they're really a mess, and it's you know, it's hard for consumers to know what they're looking at and to realize that most of these are really quality, and it's about making better decisions.
So Emily Broadley, that's Walmart. What would you like to see on the federal level in a uniform food safety date law?
Well, I think actually I like the language they went with, the best if used by. We earlier this year did a national study of consumer perceptions of date labels. So it was a representative sample. We did it with the National Consumers League and the Center for a Livable Future at Johns Hopkins University. And we also found best if used by, about 70% of people thought that meant that this was a quality date. So if people think that, let's go in that direction. Let's standardize the, you know, 99% of foods where it's about quality with one label. But I think it is really important for the foods that we mentioned that are safety risk to have a different label on those so that consumers can see that and know immediately that they should be making a different decision with those foods.
And that's our a use-by, right? A solid use-by?
Well, actually, it's so interesting. Our study found that use-by is actually probably the most confusing word to use. 42% of people thought that use-by meant it was unsafe, and 40% thought use-by meant it was not as peak quality. So to me, that shows that that's actually probably the most confusing term. But it's a term that's used in other countries. I think if we were to go with that term, we'd have to do some education. We found that the term expires on about 54% of people thought that was a safety word.
Okay,
and so I think that kind of, you know, people see expires and they're like, I shouldn't eat this anymore.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. Expires on for safety and quality, best if used by. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Dana, just one more question on this before we move on. You know, what are the odds? Do you think this is going to get through, something like this would get through Congress?
Well, you know, as we know, nothing's easy to get through Congress, but I do think this has a good shot. You know, we've been working closely with industry. As Emily mentioned, Walmart's been a real leader on this. That's been really helpful. And this has always struck me as something kind of like cleaning out your closet that, you know, everyone kind of has meant to do and not gotten around to doing. So bottom line, there's no real opposition to it. It's just a matter of finding the right solution that really works for everyone. So I think it's got a lot of promise.
All right, let's get to some calls. Amanda in Flemington, New Jersey, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. What's your question?
So I live on the largest organic farm in the state of New Jersey, and we are essentially a zero-waste farm. So we produce pork, beef, and poultry on the farm, as well as produce. And anything that we sell in our store, if it expires or if we're picking produce and it's like an ugly tomato or something that can't be sold, is actually fed to the animals. And they're all fed on pasture, so there's no factory farming. Do you see this as kind of where our food is going to be shifting to in the future? Because right now we're looked at as pretty revolutionary, although it's very old-fashioned. Whereas the factory farms and our conventional farming and use of different, you know, methods that way is looked at as the way to farm now. So do you see this as being something that's going to change, maybe back to the old ways?
So quick question for you, Amanda, before I toss that to Dana Gunders. How did you come about to being a waste-free organic farm? Why embrace that?
Ultimately, it's you have to think about the effects that you are having on the environment and the world that you're living in by doing what you're doing. So by not using chemicals or pesticides, we don't want to damage the water table. By reusing all of the food that we produce, the nutrients that go into the food, if they're not consumed by a person, we want the nutrients to go back into the animals who will then, for a polite way to put it, recycle them back into the earth on pasture when they go to the bathroom. Mm. It's about keeping your nutrients local and not needing to add more or unnecessary amounts.
Amanda, thank you so much for the call to Radio Times. And Dana Gunder, so they've kind of changed their outlook on use of waste food. Do you see this this movement, I guess, growing? Where are we with this in the United States?
Well, I think that sounds fantastic. I do think it's growing. My sense is not quickly enough. Across the U.S., less than 1% of all the farmland in the U.S. is organic today, even with all of the organic that we see in our stores. So I think she's absolutely right that a lot of the kind of fundamentals of our industrial food system do lead to waste in ways that, you know, it's very difficult for these mass farms to recycle things in the way that she was describing. So I think definitely there are opportunities that small-scale agriculture present that that are just really difficult to achieve with larger stuff. On the flip side, there's some, you know, big efficiencies that happen with larger scale things. But bottom line, it would be beautiful if all of our food were produced that way, but I don't think that's in our near future.
Well, if food is not wasted, then money is saved. Does that apply to large-scale agriculture as well?
It sure does.
I mean, as far as an incentive.
Absolutely. It applies to large-scale agriculture just as it applies to us in our homes or, you know, anyone in their own operations. If you waste less, it saves you money. So there are incentives there for sure. What you find in some cases is that, and this is certainly true for operations like restaurants or grocery stores, is that while there's certainly a cost to food and they will save money if they waste less of it, their biggest costs are actually real estate and labor. And so they're operating in a way to kind of maximize their profits, and that is more oriented around labor and sometimes space than it is around maximizing the use of the food that they're working with.
Comment from Vivian. France passed a law against food waste in April that required supermarkets to offer food that's past the sell-by date for free. Could something like this help reduce food waste in the U.S.? Could something like this fly in the U.S., Emily Broadley?
I'm actually really glad. Thank you, Vivian, for that comment. This was sort of where I wanted to go. You know, one of the challenges sort of in this context where it's not that expensive for companies to throw food away, one way that we're changing that calculation has been a series of states, including my state, Massachusetts, that have passed what are called organic waste bans in landfills. And what this means is that it really came from an issue of landfills getting too full with a bunch of things and them realizing, you know, more than 20% of the landfill was consumed with food that was thrown away. So the way that these rules work is that they say you can't send food waste to the landfill. There's cutoffs. In Massachusetts, it's businesses that are going to send more than a ton of food waste to a landfill in a week. So it's still kind of big businesses. But other states have started with businesses and are working their way down to smaller and smaller scales. So in Vermont, for example, this will impact all stores and schools and even household levels. And this really changes that calculus by saying we understand that food might be cheap, but you have to figure out something else to do. You have to reduce the amount of waste. You have to donate it if possible. And in fact, Vermont saw a 50% increase in food donations in the 6 months after they passed that rule. You have to compost it as a last resort. So they're not structured in the same way as that French law, which is really requiring that food be donated, but it has a very similar effect by saying, you know, you can't keep sending your food waste to the landfill. You need to figure out a way to do better.
Tell us about centralized composting, Dana Gunders. How does that work and what does it achieve? And I'm talking about, I guess, centralized composting on the city level. I think Seattle has a composting statute in effect.
That's right, yeah. And I live in the San Francisco area, and we have it here as well. So I can tell you, both from a personal level, that, bottom line, what composting does is a few things. One, it keeps food out of landfills, and it typically is done aerobically. It has more oxygen, and so it doesn't rot in the same way and therefore produces less greenhouse gases, less methane. So it leads to less greenhouse gases. It also recycles the nutrients. It breaks food down and allows it to go back to the soil. And so in places like San Francisco, you actually have food waste collected separate from the regular garbage. So we have three bins here. We have a black bin for garbage, a blue bin for recycling, and then a green bin where we can put both yard waste and any food from your kitchen, and that includes meat and bones and food, you know, things like pizza boxes and paper plates that you used. And it all goes off-site. It gets picked up just with your garbage and it taken to a place where it sits for a few months. And what happens to it varies by location. Here, we actually have a place where it they bring compost back so that people can, you know, when it's finished being composted, they can actually use it in their gardens.
And it works for San Franciscans? They seem to be happy with it?
You know, it works great. And what's really nice about it is that it keeps your garbage pretty clean. And you wind up taking your compost out more regularly. So I actually find it to be a much neater system in the kitchen than others. You know, and of course, I feel very spoiled that we have this. I know many cities around the country are looking to roll it out in the not-so-distant future, New York being one of them. I'm not sure about Philadelphia, but I do know that there's a lot of interest, and it's actually quite nice as a user.
So we only have a moment or so left before we need to move on. Let's talk briefly about change and how we can affect change on the individual level. Emily Broadleave, our lives are so hectic. I mean, what they're doing in San Francisco sounds great, but there's an extra step you have to take. How does the person view the person who's running at 100 miles an hour, maybe has a family to take care of and can't squeeze an extra thing into the day? How do you change their view so that they can, adopt measures to prevent food waste?
I think there's a lot of opportunity there. In some ways, it's the most challenging because everyone's living their lives, and as you say, they're busy and running around. I would say there's sort of three things that we can really do to impact the household level. One is fixing date labeling, which is, you know, one of the biggest causes of people throwing food away.
And we only have about 20 seconds. I'm sorry,
okay.
Emily.
That's okay. And I think there'll be a spillover effect of people realizing they're throwing away other foods. I think the other big one would be changing what we're talking about in schools. I think schools played a really big role in getting people to recycle and having kids bring the message home. So I think similarly with food waste, we should get them started young.
Okay. Emily Broadleave, thank you so much for joining us. Assistant Clinical Professor of Law and Director of the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic at Harvard Law School. And Dana Gunders, it was a pleasure to have you here as well. Staff Scientist at the National Resources Defense Council. We talk about cutting back on food waste at home with Sherry Brooks Vinton in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane. It's estimated that nearly 40% of all food produced here in the U.S. goes to waste. So what can we do as individuals to help reduce that figure? Sherry Brooks Vinton is author of Eat It Up, 150 recipes to use every bit and enjoy every bite of the food you buy. And Sherry, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Mary. It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
So I was thumbing through your book, and you really do mean use every bit. Let's start with broccoli as an example. If I were chopping it, I would leave I'd leave the leaves and probably a good portion of the stem. While you would do what?
I would do the opposite. The stem is actually my favorite part. It's just as flavorful as the florets, but a little bit more delicate in texture. So you don't have to throw that part out at all. Just cut the florets off and then peel the stem like you would a carrot and chop that up and add it to your recipe.
You're saying, I guess, that Americans in general really just kind of need to change the way we look at the food in front of us. Give us an overview of in general, what we're tossing that shouldn't be tossed, nose to tail, whether it's animal, vegetable, or even bread.
Sure, sure. I mean, you really hit it on the head there by making that point that we really just need to change the way that we look at food. And I think we have kind of dropped a stitch in the way that we approach our produce, and we don't see all of the value that's right in front of us. For example, when I'm in the farmer's market, I often see people handing their bunch of carrots to the farmer who chops off the green tops and hands back just the orange roots. And people think that that's all that they can eat is the root part. Same with beets. They want to eat the red beet, but they throw out the greens and then go to the next stall and buy Swiss chard. Well, you really can, you know, eat all of the greens that are on top of those root vegetables. And we've just kind of gotten out of that habit. And I think it's just a matter of sort of re-educating ourselves about all of the delicious possibilities of the food we buy.
And that's the point, re-educating, because different parts of the food taste differently. For instance, when I think of a carrot top and the greens, I think it's probably a little bit more bitter than the rest of the carrot.
It is, but it's almost like a different plant. It's a great substitute for parsley in any recipe, but you can also use it to make dips and pesto. I use it to make a nice, like a parsley oil that I use to garnish dishes. So really a lot more value if you keep those greens on your carrots.
So you're talking about spending perhaps a little more time in the kitchen experimenting?
Well, a little bit more time in the kitchen experimenting or maybe playing with your food. But if you're using up all the food you buy, you're spending a lot less time at the grocery store or maybe at the market. You know, you're going to save yourself that extra trip to buy more food. And you're going to save a lot of money because you're getting a lot more bang for your buck.
Yeah. And in your book, there is a lot of information about different things, you know, parts of vegetables like fennel, for instance, in which you say, you know, the fronds and the stalks are usually thrown out, but you use them. So tell us about the flavor of the stalks, say, in fennel.
Sure. The stalks are, they have a kind of a fibrous texture. So it's not like the bulb that you would use directly in your recipe, but they have a lot of that great licorice flavor. So they're a great addition to stocks. You can make a coeur bouillon, which is a lovely French stock that is great for poaching fish, or just throw them on the grill as a bed for maybe some fish that you want to grill, and they add that beautiful licorice flavor to the stock or to the food that you're grilling. So another possibility there. And then you can trim off the little fronds on the top and use them as you would dill in other recipes. They have that great licorice flavor, and they're great in dips or as a garnish for your prepared dishes.
So, Sherry, if a person were listening to this conversation and they wanted to really lessen the amount of waste that ends up in the kitchen garbage can, what is step one? How do you begin to do the overhaul? Let's open up the refrigerator door. What would you do?
I think the biggest reduction of food waste could come from using up your leftovers. We, you know, think about when you cook dinner, how much we just pitch, whether it's off of our plate that we haven't finished eating, or we made a little bit too much and it kind of hits the bin maybe before it should. So I would say when you're eating, you know, take as much as you want, but want everything that you take. So don't overload your plate. Go back for seconds or even thirds, but, you know, just take a little bit at a time so you're not wasting. And then every little bit of food that you can save can add up to another meal. I know when I'm cooking, it's so easy to toss out, you know, half a cup of rice or, oh, there was only one piece of chicken left and what am I going to do with that? Or a handful of, you know, steamed broccoli or something. Well, just those little bits and bobs can be turned into a whole other meal if you, you know, just have some little cards up your sleeve, little recipes that can take on leftovers.
Yeah. That reminds me of a story many years ago when my husband and I were first married. My Italian grandmother came to stay with us for a bit, and she'd make us dinner at night. We were working all day. And one night we came home to this pot of tomato sauce, and her food was always so wonderful. But we sit down to the table, and my husband takes the ladle to get some of that sauce on his pasta, and up out of the pot comes a hamburger with the cheese still on it. And then he puts the ladle back into the pot, and up comes a chicken leg, you know, and it was that's kind of comical. We were laughing. My grandmother didn't understand why we were laughing. I mean, she, you know, she came from the Depression era, and they wasted absolutely nothing. So anyway, you just reminded me of that story. I guess what you're saying is we really need to come around to that again, kind of back to the future.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Why not? You know, why not use up all of this great stuff? And many more people are going to the farmers market and buying fresh, lovely food. So why not get the most out of it? And, you know, I would not put a whole cheeseburger in my sauce, but I would chop it up and call it bolognese. You know, why not kind of enjoy every last bite of it? And I learned this from cooking with my grandmother, but also I have some chef friends. And when you go over to their house for dinner, it's amazing what they can kind of recreate out of a little bit of leftover sauce, this and that. Nothing goes to waste. A tablespoon of caramelized onions, which you might think is you know, not worth saving, can be the base for a beautiful omelet the next morning.
Okay, let's get to some particulars. Stems, peels, cobs, skins, they can all make a good vegetable broth. What's again the key to doing this so to avoid a bitter flavor?
Well, vegetable broth is a great thing to have on hand, and it's a wonderful way to use up your trims and peelings of carrots and potato peels and onion skins. You just don't want to cook it for too long. So any vegetable cooked more than 2 hours is going to go bitter. So it's a great stock to put together, maybe even while you're making dinner. Just put a pot of water on the back burner, throw in all of your peels and things, cover it with you know, get enough boiling water in there to cover what you've put in the pot, and just let it simmer while you make dinner, and then you have this great vegetable stock that you can use the next night or pop in the freezer.
All right, let's look at fish. You write of what you call trash fish. What are trash fish, and why do you recommend them?
Well, trash fish, I know it may not sound very appetizing, but trash fish are essentially bycatch. So when fisher people go out to bring in their catch, oftentimes they will pull up in their nets fish that aren't the targeted species that they are hunting for. So oftentimes they will just toss them back because there's no market for these fish. And they waste a lot of fish in the process. If we could create a market for these trash fish, which are perhaps lesser known species of fish, then they wouldn't have to toss them out. They could bring them back to the dock and we could enjoy them and we wouldn't lose fish and they could get more value out of each trip that they made. And the key to using trash fish or enjoying trash fish is to trust the people maybe around you that have a little more education about fish, like your chef or your fishmonger. If they are using a fish on their menu or they have something in their case that you're not familiar with, instead of just going into the shop or looking at the menu and picking the salmon, the shrimp, the tuna that we're all very familiar with, don't be afraid to experiment with something new. You know, ask them about it. Let them tell you about some new lovely fish that they're trying out. You know, it's I love this story of like the we have a Chilean sea bass that everyone really loved, kind of loved maybe a little bit too much because we ate it too much for a while. But that's a lovely white fish that no one was enjoying because it was called the Patagonian toothfish and they couldn't sell it and they couldn't find a market for it. And it was just not moving. And they changed the name and then everyone wanted it.
Yeah, the label is everything, right?
Look a little bit beyond the label. What's that?
No, I was just going to say the label, what you call it, counts for a lot. Sherry Brooks Vinden, you write a chapter called The Whole Beast, and in it you say you always shop for meat from animals that have been treated well. Why is that?
Well, I am a big supporter of sustainable farming practices. And as you had in the previous segment, talking to a farmer that has a holistic approach to the farm, when you do that, when you're raising animals out in the fresh air and sunshine where they should be and maybe using some rotational grazing, you're going to have a healthier animal. And when you have a healthier animal, you have a healthier meal. So it's better for the farmer and the animal and you.
So, but this meat, I would guess, is more expensive. But then on the flip side, if you don't waste as much, you make up the expense?
That's exactly it. It's about eating less meat, maybe, but eating better meat and getting everything out of the meat that you buy. For example, I wholly recommend shifting away from boneless, skinless chicken breasts and buying the whole chicken instead. Once you learn how to chop up the chicken, you will save yourself so much money in the grocery store, and you'll get such better flavor on your plate.
When I was a child, and this is moving from poultry to beef, I remember my mom going to the local grocery store and asking for beef bones, and she would make a pretty amazing soup. Is that something that's relatively easy to access today?
It's so easy to make soups and stocks from animal bones, and you hear a lot of talk about, you know, beef broth. And bone broth has been sort of the trend word. And that's just another name for the same thing that we're talking about, is making a stock. And you can do it very simply. You can roast the bones, which if you're using beef bones, you definitely want to do. It adds a richer flavor. Chicken bones, you can also roast them up. Or chicken bones, you can just put in the pot as they are. Cover with cold water, bring to a simmer, and then cook that for, you know, several hours. And sometimes I leave my pot on overnight, or you can even do it in a crock pot if that is easier for you. And then you have this delicious broth, which brings a lot of flavor to your dishes, but also has a lot of nutritive benefits. There are a lot of minerals and vitamins and elements in the bones that are not accessible any other way. You can't, we don't chew on the bones. So if you boil them in water, you get all that great, the gelatin and things that are very curative. That's why we crave like a nice hot bowl of soup when we're sick, because it really does make you better.
And again, since we've been talking about hectic lives, that crock pot can actually save some time if you set it, if you use it overnight. Sherry, you also use the bone marrow as well. You waste nothing if you have a beef bone. How do you use the bone marrow, and how do you make that appetizing?
Well, bone marrow is very popular in other cultures. If you go to France and sit down at a bistro, you will often find this on the menu. And it's very simply prepared. You're just roasting the beef bones in a nice hot oven, and then you sprinkle them with a little bit of salt, and you break out your fancy marrow spoons or a nice butter knife and dig in. It's great on toast.
And another item that you do not toss, if you're peeling an orange, you usually keep the citrus peel. You call them magical.
They are. There's so much flavor in the citrus peel. All of the citrus oil is in the peel. So you get all that lovely, the floral notes that you don't get in the juice. And you get that great citrus flavor without the sort of puckering power of the juice. So oftentimes, before I'm about to peel an orange or juice a lemon, I'll quickly use a vegetable peeler to just take off that outer layer of zest and pop that in a little freezer-proof container, throw it in my freezer. And then when my recipe calls for zest, I don't have to zest a fresh fruit that might then sit on the side of my counter and just dry out because I didn't need the juice. I can just go to my freezer and grab that zest and chop it up and throw it in my recipe.
And we didn't get to this too much, Sherry, but the freezer is key here. Tell us, as we're wrapping up the show, the best way to use your freezer.
Well, the freezer stops time. So I think of it as my home kitchen time machine. And if you have, you know, a little bit of leftover mashed potatoes or a little bit of, you know, sauce or something that you're not going to use the next night, put it in a container, throw it in the freezer. The next time you're about to make a meal, you have a running start.
Sherry
Same
Brooks Vinden.
Surplus.
I'm sorry, I've got to stop you there. Thank you so much for joining us.
You know,
Sherry Brooks Vinton is author of Eat It Up, 150 recipes to use every bit and enjoy every bite of the food you buy. Don't forget, check out our Facebook page for more about Radio Times at whyy.org/Radio Times. Our engineer today has been Kevin Griffin. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Elizabeth Fiedler. And we had help from Madison Poulter today. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, sitting in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times.